Welcome to this week's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Today we're taking a look at where education funding stands in the state budget. Chelsea Lewis of Wisconsin Trails joins us to talk about a dragon boat race with a deeper meaning in northern Wisconsin. And Tyler Dunn gives us a look ahead at the upcoming Packers season. First, investigative reporter John Diedrich sat down with me to discuss his latest story. I should warn you, parts of the story are graphic in nature. John's looking at how a criminal with a history of sexual violence was allowed to become a licensed social worker in the state of Wisconsin.
So this story is about a guy by the name of Francis Deisler. Deisler grew up in New York. He has a criminal history that really goes back to when he's a child. And these are all revealed in court records that we obtained later. He had a lot of run-ins with the law, some serious sex crimes as a child when he was underage, and then was involved in theft and fraud and bank robberies and so forth through up until his early 20s. And then what happens is he ends up getting wrapped up with the mob. And through that process, he ends up getting basically a get-out-of-jail-free card from the federal authorities that allow him to get out from all the different crimes that he's convicted of in New York and get a fresh start. And that's what he does in the early 70s when he comes to Wisconsin. He marries his then-third wife, and with her four children, they move to Wisconsin. At the age, he's 33 years old at that point. And that's when we really pick up a lot of the crimes that happened here in Wisconsin.
And what are some of those crimes?
So what happens is he gets here, and he actually becomes an insurance agent when he first comes here, lies on his application. That lie ends up catching up with him. And then what's very interesting is he goes on a series of horrific crimes in the area around Port Washington, Fredonia area where he's living. There's a series of sexual assaults, stranger sexual assaults. There's a bank robbery. There's burglaries, kidnappings, things of this nature, some of which he did with a partner, but a number of these he did alone. And what his MO was, modus operandi was, is that he would find families that were selling their home through the newspaper, and he and a partner or himself would go to the house and meet with the couple who were selling the home, and then he would scout it out and come back later when the husband was gone at work, and he would rape the wife as she was home alone. This happened in Milwaukee, it happened in Sheboygan, and he was suspected in three or four other sexual assaults in the area. In addition to that, he kidnapped a 14-year-old girl in Milwaukee and brought her sexually assaulted her in Germantown. In addition to that, he robbed a bank with his partner, and then he was involved in a number of burglaries. So what you would consider a very serious offender. And then what happens in his story is all the more surprising based on those crimes. So he goes to prison, and at that time, it's interesting, you don't end up going away like you would now for sexual assault. He was deemed to be basically mentally ill, had mental aberrations, and he went to a state hospital. He spent 2 years there, a total of 2 years for the sexual assaults, and they said, you're better, you're ready to get out. The only problem for him is that he still had the armed robbery. So that meant another 8 years or so behind bars. During that time, he started taking classes and got his master's degree remotely while he was in prison with the goal of becoming a social worker. He paid for this with disability payments that he was receiving from the federal government during that period of time. And so what happens is he actually gets declared a alcohol and drug counselor certified in the state of Wisconsin while he's behind bars. And once he gets out and he finishes serving his time, then he seeks to be registered as licensed as a social worker in Wisconsin as well as two other states. And what we found out in this investigation is that there were not background checks that were done on individuals in the early 1990s when he obtained this. And perhaps most interesting for our, folks here in Wisconsin is that there still isn't a background check for people who apply to be social workers. In essence, it's an honor system.
Now, in your story, you had a quote from a spokeswoman who said that the reason this honor system exists is that they haven't had issues like this before, that it's pretty fail-proof. Do we know if that is a verified statement? Is there any way to check that?
Well, we don't know. And what's interesting is the only people that they do check are the people who actually say, I've been convicted of a crime. So if an individual says, I've been convicted of a crime, then they'll do the background check. But that sort of assumes that people are going to tell the truth each time, and that might withhold, you know, information. And we know in this case, Francis Deisler lied on his application in Michigan. We know that because they retain the application in Michigan. They retain the application in Indiana. They do not in Wisconsin, another place where Wisconsin law is behind other states. So you have individuals who have reason to lie. Now, in the case of Deisler, he's 76 years old and he's retiring and so forth. He's not in Wisconsin any longer. But what this really raises is these questions about what sorts of safeguards are in the system here in Wisconsin.
John showed me the binder with his research notes for this. The details he collected stretch back decades, including Deisler's license applications from Indiana and Michigan. If you're interested in more on the story, visit jsonline.com. Shifting gears into the lighter world of sports, I'm joined today by Journal Sentinel Packers beat writer Tyler Dunn. Tyler is covering minicamp in Green Bay. He talked about what he will watch for in the team's final 3 days.
They'll have this last week at minicamp, and then the players are gone until the start of training camp in late July. So it's the last chance for a lot of the young players to get acclimated and really get their feet wet with the playbook, know what they have to do going into training camp when the pads come on, and then the job interview really begins. But I'm kind of looking at those year two guys, the ha-ha Clinton Dixons of the world, the Davante Adams, the Richard Rodgers. These are the players that, you know, they got a lot of playing time, maybe 300, 400 snaps last year, but really looking to ascend in even bigger roles this coming year. I mean, you look at a guy like Davante Adams. There was a practice 2 weeks ago where Aaron Rodgers went to him 4 times in a 2-minute drill. I think that that's a player you're going to see targeted a lot more next year. Seems a lot more comfortable, and he just has, like Rodgers said himself, rare physical tools. But you don't see a lot of that position. So expect Davante Adams to really take a big step this year.
Tyler believes the team isn't making any overhauls to their game plan, but they have some room for minor tweaks.
Schematically, there aren't a ton of macro changes to this team. I mean, the offense is almost back in full with Cobb and Belaga back. But defensively, they're still looking for different ways to use Clay Matthews. And I think that was a big question going into OTAs and minicamp. Is this inside linebacker thing something that's going to stick to some extent, or are they just going to throw that out? Where he played inside linebacker about a quarter of the time the last half of the 2014 season. Looks like that's going to remain, and they're going to keep using him inside in some sub-packages, which is a little bit of a surprise. You thought that maybe they just leave him at his best position, rush the passer and outside linebacker, but I think that it's schematically, this is how they want to keep offense guessing, keep quarterbacks guessing, move Clay Matthews around throughout the defense, and this is a time that you can experiment with that a little bit. And going into training camp, I'd expect that experimentation to really continue.
You can read Tyler's analysis and plenty more about the Packers in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and on the web at jsonline.com/Packers. Have you heard of the controversy surrounding raw milk? Business reporter Rick Barrett wrote about one Minnesota farmer who could face some legal repercussions after attempting to sell some. Here's Rick on what makes raw milk so controversial.
Raw milk is so controversial because there are basically two camps. There are the people who strongly believe that it has beneficial properties that are not found in a pasteurized product. And they also believe that it should be a freedom of choice issue. And they see that as something that's very important to them. On the other side, public health officials, state agriculture department officials, the Food and Drug Administration will all say the risk outweigh the benefits, if there are any benefits.
And it's illegal in Wisconsin.
It is and it isn't. If you are living on a farm and you want to drink your own milk that's unpasteurized, that's totally fine. If you go to a farm occasionally and just say, I would like to buy a gallon of raw milk for my own personal consumption, and the farmer agrees to it, then you can do that. It's called an incidental sale, but it's very limited. It's supposed to be just a once in a while, occasional thing. You're not supposed to be a repeat customer, and that's where you get into trouble if someone keeps going back over and over.
And your story this week is about a farmer from Minnesota who is attempting to sell it in Wisconsin, right?
Well, this farmer in Minnesota, he has some dairy goats. And what he's done is he put an ad on Craigslist in La Crosse for unpasteurized goat's milk. Well, if he were in Wisconsin, he'd be in trouble pretty quickly because you can't advertise anywhere raw milk. That's a violation of the occasional incidental rule. However, he's in Minnesota, and Wisconsin officials don't have any jurisdiction there. So that there you have to look at the Minnesota law. And what that says is you can also have an occasional sale, but you have to go directly to the farm to buy it, just like you would in Wisconsin. He's offering to meet people in various places and do the transaction, which would get him in trouble in Minnesota. And if he crossed the state line in Wisconsin, it would get him in trouble here.
Why is he offering to do it then?
You know, he just has a few extra gallons a week that he wants to sell. It's his daughter's 4-H project. And his idea is it's very innocent. It's just that he believes that people want this, they're willing to pay a little bit for it, and, you know, he doesn't see any harm in it whatsoever. He's not trying to make a business out of it. But it could quickly get him in a lot of trouble for various reasons. One of them could be that if someone were to get sick from this, he would be in an enormous amount of trouble very quickly.
Despite potential risks, regulators have been somewhat lax in pursuing raw milk sales. Find out more about this topic with Rick's story, available at jsonline.com/business. Another week has passed, and the legislature remains gridlocked on certain budget items. Aaron Richards, Daniel Bice, Greg Borowski, and Jason Stein examine the budget's effect on education during this week's JS on Politics show.
So you had a story this morning in the newspaper and online about, you know, where all these issues stand. You know, lower education, K-12, got a lot of the funding restored, but there seem to be all these other issues that are troubling folks in education.
Right. Yeah. It's certainly been a contentious package of education proposals pushed by the GOP. You know, the public school folks have really risen up and sort of opposed a lot of the changes in the budget. But what the Republicans are saying is, look, we gave you the $127 million back that Walker had proposed cutting in the second year of the budget. Now, they did that alongside proposing the expansion of the statewide voucher program and putting some other things in the budget, like special needs vouchers. So you're really seeing the public school communities rise up and say, we have to continue to fight this. But the Republicans, who control the legislature, haven't signaled that there's much wiggle room on anything but one proposal about teacher training.
But, you know, one thing is, Governor Walker pays attention to these things. And frequently, when people insert things into the budget, the Republicans don't respond. It hasn't happened that way in the past, but then Walker comes in at the last second with a veto. So when these groups are lobbying and trying to get these things out of the budget, you need to remember that it might not just have an impact on Voss and Fitzgerald, but Walker's in the background and can knock these things out if he doesn't think they are good.
Let's bring in Jason Stein from our Madison Bureau. So a lot of these issues that are currently on the table, and we're talking about, you know, expansion of private school choice, you know, more chartering, these takeover of poor MPS schools, these are things that were inserted by the lawmakers. Do you have a sense, Jason, about what the governor supports or doesn't support, or is he going to just sort of accept most of what's sent forward to him?
The governor typically does end up supporting most of the things that are inserted in the budget by his own party, because obviously they're not doing that in a vacuum. I mean, they're talking with him and his people as they're putting these things in. I mean, it doesn't mean he supports every one of them, but they're typically just not going to throw something into the state budget, his state budget, without at least running it past him. You know, that being said, he's going to veto some of these things for sure. I think particularly as he runs as a conservative in the Republican primary for the White House, you know, undeclared candidate, he is going to be looking for what are some vetoes that can really burnish my credentials as a conservative. So particularly anything that would introduce new spending or that sort of thing could have a veto bullseye on it.
Well, let's Aaron, you've covered education for many years now. Talk about, assume that most of these things are going to go through, right? Some might get vetoed or trimmed or shaved a little bit by the governor, but what's the headline then at the end of the budget? What has happened to education? Who's running education policy? And we've gone rightward, of course, but what are the big takeaways for people?
Well, I think the power has really shifted, and what you're seeing is there's been a Republican appetite to send more public money to private or at least independent school options that don't have to answer to a school board in the name of increasing efficiencies and increasing innovation. And I think that's where you're going to see the power really shift. I mean, this whole budget has really focused on kind of reducing districts' impact a little bit, and in the long run, if some of these options are expanded, it will, in the long run, reduce some of their funding as well. What the sentiment is that districts will sort of rise up and compete against these options.
If you're looking for more on education or anything related to politics, visit jsonline.com/politics for complete coverage. Have you ever heard of dragon boat racing? I hadn't either. Chelsea Lewis of the Journal Sentinel's Wisconsin Trails clued me in on this type of racing and why it's so important to some women.
What is dragon boat racing?
Dragon boat racing is kind of a mix between crew and canoeing. Essentially, it involves a long, narrow boat. Typically, you have 20 paddlers in the boat, kind of sitting in pairs next to each other. You have a drummer, and then you have a steer person at the back. So the drummer keeps beat for the paddlers, and then the paddlers paddle like they would a canoe. It kind of looks like a canoe paddle. The stroke is a little different, but it's pretty much the same. And then there are races and festivals all over the country, all over the world now.
All right, and there's a big one coming up in La Crosse. Now, what makes this one special when it comes to one of the teams?
So the one in La Crosse is actually a fundraiser for breast cancer. It's put on by a hospital in La Crosse, and there's actually a pretty close tie between breast cancer and dragon boat racing, because back in the 90s, this doctor in Canada, dragon boat racing is really big in Canada. Pretty much everyone I talked to said it was second only to hockey as a sport there. I don't know if I believe that, but okay. So anyway, this doctor in Canada, he's a sports medicine specialist. The conventional wisdom at the time was that breast cancer survivors shouldn't do extensive exercise, especially on the side of their body that maybe had been affected. Like if their left breast had been affected, they shouldn't do strenuous exercise on that side, because there was fear that it would make their lymphedema worse, or it could bring on lymphedema. Lymphedema is a side effect of breast cancer treatments. It's swelling in the arms or any other part of the body. So this doctor kind of said, I don't know if I believe that, and let's test it. So he actually put together a dragon boat team of survivors, breast cancer survivors, and they paddled together, and the results of the study were amazing. Not only did these women not have worsening of their lymphedema, a lot of them didn't even develop it, and the emotional and social benefits of being a part of a team doing this awesome activity together were just outstanding. So from that point on, there was kind of always this close tie between breast cancer and dragon boat racing because of that study. So it's kind of exploded across the country. I talked to one woman who said that dragon boat racing is the only international sport where there's actually a sanctioned division for survivors. So I thought that was pretty cool. And so that's kind of where that tie comes from.
Wow. What is it like to, talk to women who participate in this?
Yeah, pretty much everyone I talk to who is a survivor who does dragon boat racing, just they talked a lot about the unity of the sport and how it was really incredible. You know, you go through treatments and you can be a part of the support group and, you know, feel like there's support there. But to do this, like, strenuous physical activity with other survivors and to just kind of feel like you're reclaiming your life after you're battling, you know, this life-threatening disease was really amazing. And one woman called them like her sisters. They kind of formed this sisterhood, which was super cool. And she talked about how she built these lifelong friendships that translated to outside of the sport. And so, you know, she was going through the La Crosse airport one time and she was super frazzled. And she kind of looked up and the TSA agent woman was like smiling at her and was like, hey, Corey. And it kind of dawned on her this was her dragon boat sister. And so she kind of was like calmed by that presence. And so it's a silly story, but it kind of represents how it's not just a sport for them. It's about unity, and it's about teamwork, and it's about living life.
How did you find out about this story?
Oh, a woman from La Crosse contacted me who's affiliated with the hospital that sponsors it and said, you know, we have this pretty cool event we've been doing for a few years. And I had heard of Dragon Boat racing before, but I had heard of it in the context of the Lake Superior Dragon Boat Festival, which is actually one of the biggest festivals in the country. So they do that one up in Superior and northern Wisconsin. But I wasn't really aware of the tie with breast cancer. So I just thought that was a really cool and interesting part of the story.
And that does it for today's show. Of course, there's more coming next week. Music writer Piet Levy joins me with a look ahead at this year's Summerfest. And we'll have a follow-up report from Raquel Rutledge on an investigation she did into diacetyl, a potentially deadly substance commonly found in chips, candy, and coffee. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great week.